Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody. Coast to coast, This Week in America. How does a debutante become a scientist? And what happens when she uncovers the dark underbelly of academic research? In the crying window, renowned radiation biologist and professor emerita, Dr. Helena Z. Hill, shares her extraordinary decade-spanning journey where she went from cocktail dresses and finishing schools to Harvard labs and whistleblower lawsuits. This memoir is a first-hand account of the persistent sexism and systemic failures women in science continue to face. It's also a reflection on integrity, what it costs, and why it matters. Dr. Hill received a Ph.D. in biology from Brandeis University in 1964. She was a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard, at the University of Colorado Medical Schools, and she rose through the ranks from assistant to full professor at the medical schools of the University of Colorado, Washington University in St. Louis, Marshall University, Huntington, West Virginia, and the New Jersey Medical School in Newark, New Jersey. Dr. Hill retired in 2016 and is professor emerita at Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey. She's co-authored more than 80 scientific publications, awarded the Smith College Award in 1997. Dr. Hill has written Hidden Data, The Blind Eye of Science, and co-wrote with Amy Yerzinski, Cover Up, Collusion in the Halls of Academia, which we've done, studied, and talked about here on This Week in America. And back with us on the program, the author of The Crying Window, memoir of a female scientist looking for truth, Dr. Helena Z. Hill. Dr. Hill, welcome back. A pleasure, as always, to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Such a fascinating story in what you went through, the illustrious career that you went through, and continuing to help women who's trying to find their place in the scientific community. Let's start with the motivation for writing The Crying Window. Why was it important for you to tell this story?
Well, I think I wanted other women to know that you have to believe in yourself and you just have to keep fighting for what you believe in.
And you've done that throughout.
Never give up.
That is so true, and we'll talk about that as the story unfolds here in The Crying Window. Our guest is Helena Z. Hill. Her website, by the way, very simple, hzhill.net. A link on her website, thisweekinamerica.us. Were there a few women in science when you started your career? Talk about what that was like when you started your scientific career.
Well, you know, I guess I started at Harvard as a postdoctoral fellow, and there weren't very many women as postdoctoral fellows as was I, but I never felt that there was any discrimination against us. But I think I really didn't realize the signs of discrimination. I had actually discovered something that was kind of minor. We were looking at protein synthesis in rat liver, and I discovered that in order for the protein albumin, which is the major protein in blood, to get out of the liver cells and into the circulation, it had to be clipped. It had to have a few bases removed from it. And the professor that I was working for, who was running the lab, didn't believe my results. And so we kind of soft-pedaled them in the papers that I wrote. And as a result of that, somebody else has gotten credit for that discovery. It isn't a great discovery, but it is really important, and it's too bad that it wasn't attributed to the studies that I was doing. And that was just the way it was with women. We weren't believed. It was believed that we couldn't do a good job. We were just not as smart as the men.
And you talk about that, the fact that they did not think intellectually you were inferior to the men. When did you first realize that? It sounds like in that case that you were talking about, it hit home pretty heavily at that point. When did you realize that they are treating me differently?
I think I realized it after Harvard Medical School. I had gone to all girls schools up and through college. And so I had never had any classes with men until I was in graduate school. And at Brandeis, I didn't feel that there was any kind of discrimination at all. I felt that I was just really one of the boys. And there were a couple of other graduate students who were female in the biology department. And we all got along just fine. So I never really realized until I got to Colorado, that there was discrimination against women.
You talk in the book, The Crying Window, about a newspaper story. A reporter asked you about discrimination, and then you really started to give it some serious thought. Talk about that, because out of that came, well, you formed a women's organization there. You did an extensive research into men and women scientists at the facility. Was that a turning point for you when you were asked that question in the interview?
I'm afraid I can't really hear you very well. Could you say that a little louder?
Yeah, let me go back and refresh, start that again. You're talking in the book, The Crying Window, about a newspaper story in the Denver Post, and he asked about your thoughts on discrimination. You talk about that being sort of a point when you started looking into things and were surprised at what you found. Was that a turning point for you?
It was absolutely a turning point because, as I said, I'd had an all-girl education up until Brandeis, and then there was no discrimination at Brandeis, and I hadn't really woken up to the discrimination that I was subject to at the Harvard Medical School. So when I looked into and another woman who was in the pathology department worked with me, we looked into the personnel action forms. We were allowed access to them by the dean of the men and the women in the at the Colorado Medical School. It turns out that there were very few women, and most of them were not getting promoted. And the men, of course, were moving up and doing just fine. And the women's pay was much less than the men's, and so forth. So when I reported that to the dean and to his committee that were in that supported him, I expected that they would say, "Oh, we didn't know we were discriminating against the women, and we'll take care of that right away." Well, they took care of that all right. I was called into my chairman's office, and he said, "You're not going to get tenure. You're going to have to leave." So that was kind of the beginning of my wake-up call.
Well, it hit firsthand, and you account that meeting when you go in and suddenly you realize it's turned against you. That's such an amazing story and what you went through. During this process, as you're working, you're also raising a family. Talk about juggling all of this. Your career is on the rise, and you go home and you have to be mom at home and take care of the family. What was that like, that extra having both jobs to do, basically?
In Colorado, we were very lucky. Well, we had purchased an absolutely fabulous house, and it had a wing over the garage that was a small apartment. And so we would give the apartment rent-free to a couple who would in order to make up for the rent that they didn't pay, they would were asked to look after the children. And most of them came from other countries, and they were really wonderful.
Oh,
And
yes.
they took good care of our kids most of the time. I mean, we did run into a few that weren't so great. Basically, that worked out very well, so that they were taken care of
And then
while I went to work.
you're confronted. You love the lifestyle there. The family loves living in Colorado, and then the rug is literally pulled out from under you. What was that like? And how many times did you go through that in your career where you were forced to adjust, to make adjustments because of you're a woman in a man's world?
Well, I had to go and talk to the president of the university, the whole university, which was terribly intimidating. And the problem with women, I don't think it happens to men so much, but when you're confronted with something like that, and I'm sitting there trying to explain to him and talk to him and hopefully save my career, I burst into tears. And totally could not control that. That was just so humiliating. It was one of the blackest moments in my life, I think. Nothing you can do about it. You just, there those tears are. I don't think men do it as much as women.
And you talk about that again in the book. The book is The Crying Window. You'll find it wherever books are sold, along with Dr. Hill's other books. Her website is hzhill.net. We've got a link on our website, thisweekinamerica.us, that will take you directly there. Your career is going along, and suddenly you feel that you've caught a fellow researcher basically cheating, coming up with misinformation. Talk about that, when you first realized that was going on and you first became a whistleblower.
That was towards the end of my career, when we wound up in at the New Jersey Medical School in Newark. And I had decided that I wasn't going to apply for grants anymore. I was tired of writing grants. The possibility of having your grant funded from the NIH was pretty small. It was about 15% of the grants would be funded. And, you know, you spend your lifetime writing grants and then you don't get them. And so I decided that I would put my oar in with a young fellow who was just getting started in the same department that I was in, the radiology department. And he had a postdoctoral fellow who was working for him, and I wound up doing experiments alongside of that guy, and that was when I realized that he was fabricating data. And so I reported it to his boss, and things went downhill from there. I had to report it to a committee that was established to look into charges like mine, and they didn't believe me, and so I kept on.
How difficult was it?
I kept on repeating, you know, going back, and after I found more and more evidence that this fellow was cheating, and I just didn't give up.
What were the ramifications of that cheating on this research work? Not only the fact that there was money at stake, but there could be lives at stake down the line if people are fabricating evidence.
Then they never really got caught. The postdoctoral fellow went on to bigger and better things, because I filed a lawsuit. It's called a QUITAM. It's QUITAM. And basically what it says, that I'm a relator, and I'm charging that the government has been defrauded because there was a government grant that was involved in this particular thing. And the QUITAM lawsuit, I think, began its life in the second, in the middle of the 19th century. So it's a very old type of lawsuit, and it really doesn't fit scientific data. And so I lost that one. I lost, you know, basically every time I went up to the committees at the New Jersey Medical School, I lost. But I just never gave up. And the way I think I'm winning now is that I wrote a book.
And you've got it all laid out there. In fact, the book is doing so well. The title of this one is The Crying Window. Now, we've talked about other books that were written by Dr. Hill, along with Amy Yarzynski, the book we talked about the last time the doctor was with us, Cover Up Collusion in the Halls of Academia, also Hidden Data, The Blind Eye of Science. Did anybody in the scientific community stand behind you as you were pressing the lawsuits and trying to call out what you saw going on, or were you out there by yourself?
I was really pretty much by myself. I think, you know, that's a very good question. I certainly have friends now who would back me up, but at the time, I really was a loner, and I just had to keep on believing, knowing that I was right. I mean, as as time went on, and I went from one committee to another committee, and to the NIH and their committee, I got more information, and I learned more ways of analyzing the data. And when I filed the QI-TAM, I needed to have expert witnesses, and I had a statistician. I found a statistician in New Jersey who was just a wonderful, wonderful person. And when we analyzed the numbers that were behind the data that were on graphs that were in publications that these fellows had published, we found that those numbers, they were supposed to be statistically random, and that those numbers definitely were not random. They were fabricated. And we found more and more data that we could show was fabricated. But when this whole thing went before the judge didn't understand anything about statistics. And as far as he was concerned, that wasn't even something to consider. So he ruled against me.
You know, as people are listening, they're probably thinking, okay, you caught this one case when this happened. You were on top of it. And even though you lost legally, you brought this out, called attention to it. How prevalent is this, was this, where fabrications were part of the process?
I think there are statistics on that. There's I can't think of the name of the website that deals with this type of data fabrication. But I think the estimate is that probably maybe 5%, maybe more than that, of scientists are actually making up data.
You relate,
and getting away with it.
Well, yeah, that's the sad thing. And hopefully this will open some eyes as people read your book and follow your story. For the latter part of your career, you were known as the whistleblower. Was that something that bothered you, that designation, or were you proud of it? Because you went up against the odds, and even though legally you weren't successful, you went up against the odds and took on people that were doing something that was totally wrong.
Oh, no, I'm a whistleblower. There's no doubt about it. Am I proud of it? I'm sad about it. I didn't like being a whistleblower. When we were little, I had an older sister, and she would tattletale on me. We used to chant something, tattletale tit, your tongue shall be split, and all the something in the, and all the monkeys or something like that in the world shall have a part of it. Being a tattletale is not a nice thing, but you have to do it.
Well, yes,
you know, especially when several million dollars were at stake here.
Of government
funds.
Yeah, government funds. It's the taxpayers' money that was being bandied
right,
back and
right.
forth.
Exactly.
If you were to talk with women now involved that are thinking about a career in science, how much has it changed? We're going through maybe a little regression now, but how much has it changed? And what advice would you give to somebody that's starting off in a field that's been predominantly male for a number of years?
Well, you know, I was on the faculty at the New Jersey Medical School in the end. And over the course of the time that I was there, I was there for 35 years or something like that. The balance of genders in the medical school class kept increasing, more and more women. And now I think there are maybe more than half of the women who are going to medical school, or half of the students who are going to medical school, are women.
Yes.
And I think that's just wonderful. I'm so glad that women are recognized as being just as good as men when they're doctors. I think they're better, actually. They have a more sympathetic point of view, I think.
You know, I think that's interesting, and I think I've noticed that in dealing with the medical community, just in things that my wife and I have gone through, that I believe there is truth to that. What's it like in retirement for you? It seems like you've got a very busy life going on. What's it like now?
Since the book has been published, I can't say the phone has been ringing off the hook, but I sure am getting a lot of email. And now I have to worry about whether things that I'm being asked to subscribe to are legitimate or not. And that's a whole different ballpark to scientific misconduct. Because there are apparently a lot of scams out there for people who write books like mine. And so I have to be really careful what I subscribe to and what I agree to do.
Well, you've been very successful. You've picked and chosen very well. You've been very successful with the books that you've had out there. And The Crying Window is really, it talks about integrity, doing the right thing, what you had to go through, which is shocking. And not that many decades ago when Dr. Rehal went through this, and the story comes to life in her book, The Crying Window. I'd like to thank Prominent Books Edge for arranging this conversation. You get more than a publisher. You get a team wired into industry leaders, marketing mavericks, and design wizards, prominentbooksedge.com. Doctor, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. You'll find all the books and information when you go to Dr. Hill's website, which is hzhill.net. You can click on by going to our website, thisweekinamerica.us. The new book is The Crying Window. It is always a pleasure to talk with you on the program. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
It is always a pleasure. The book, The Crying Window, Dr. Hill's website is hzhill.net. You're listening to This Week in America, and we continue on today's program right after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.